Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 80. 80! 80! This one is entitled The Fallacy of Christianity, and we are going to talk about Matthew chapter 22, and we're going to jump right in at verse 34. This is one of the most famous passages in Scripture and one of the most famous sayings of Jesus. We read, "When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked Jesus a question to test him. 'Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?' Jesus said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets.'" This story of Jesus is good news for anyone that doesn't like Bible study. Jesus, who Christians profess to be the Son of God, gives you the cliff notes for all of the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians refer to as the Old Testament. He says, "You want to know what the most important commandment is? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." These two commandments are what Jesus boils the entire Hebrew Bible down to, which means we should spend some time here. With this podcast today, we're going to talk about the first of these commandments, the commandment that says you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. Not only that, but we're going to talk about it independently of loving your neighbor. Because a lot of people think that just loving God is the same thing as loving your neighbor, but Jesus clearly separates them. So during this Paradox Podcast episode, we're going to talk about what it means to love God with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all our mind. Next week, on episode 81, we'll be talking about what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. The week after that, we are having a guest speaker. My church history professor, Katie Parsons Coe, is going to come and speak on the life of Martin Luther, because we're about to hit the 500-year anniversary of the nailing of the 95 Theses on the German church at Wittenberg. I think that was the longest sentence I've ever said on a podcast episode. I'm not even sure how long that one was. But anyways, 2 weeks from now, Katie Parsons Coe will be on this podcast, and she will talk about Martin Luther to commemorate the 500-year anniversary. And then the week after that, we're going to close out our series in the book of Matthew by talking about resurrection on October 28th. Now, I wanted to mention that teaching because today, during this podcast, I'm going to be talking about the resurrection from the perspective of this passage. That being said, it will raise all kinds of questions about what the resurrection actually means in 2017. And we can't fully get into that because we're trying to focus on what it means to love the Lord your God with all of your being. So I want to tell you this because when we talk about the resurrection and what it means, I want you to know that we're devoting a full teaching to this in 3 weeks' time. So if you feel like there are more questions that need to be answered or more questions that need to be raised, then make sure that you tune in on October 28 or after with the podcast, and we will for sure talk about what the resurrection is, and we'll devote an entire teaching to it. So with that in mind, let's talk about the passage today where Jesus says the first and greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Now, when I was younger, whenever I heard someone say the words, "I love God," I always rejoiced, because I had been raised in a Christian home and I knew it was important to love God. But as I have gotten older, I have found that when somebody says, "I love God," in public, there's a question that forms in my head now, which is, what does that mean? What does it mean to love God? Because I know a lot of people that love God, and it enables all sorts of behaviors. Some of these behaviors are beautiful, and others of these behaviors are awful, and yet they all credit the reason for these behaviors as their love for God. To give you an example, Mother Teresa lived one of the greatest humanitarian lives this world has ever known. And the reason she gave for her selfless, compassionate work was her love for God. Her love for God motivated her to hold dying bodies in the sewers of India. And she says, "The reason I do this is because I love God so much." Conversely, We have all heard of a terrorist or a religious zealot who says it is their love of God that motivates them to kill one or two or massive amounts of people. And what I found to be true in this life is that love of God is not the same as love of good. Love of God is not the same as love of good. And this is something I would have thought earlier in my life, but I have found it simply to not be true. Just because someone says, I love God, doesn't mean much until you look specifically at their life. Now, if you are someone who considers themselves outside of the Christian tradition, and you hear Jesus say these words, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, there are two questions that usually pop up, and these are questions that people outside of Christianity often ask Christians. The first is, why should humans love God? The second is, how should humans love God? These are two difficult questions to answer. And it's important that when we ask difficult questions, we go to someone who has all of the answers. And if you don't know anybody that knows all of the answers, I want you to know that I know someone who does know all the answers. The person who knows all the answers is 17-year-old Craig. Now, some things that are important to know about 17-year-old Craig is he thought he had all the answers. Not only that, but 17-year-old Craig was not really one of the cool kids. But if you would have approached him as someone outside of the Christian tradition and said, hey, 17-year-old Craig, why should I love God? I know that I, 17 years ago, would have told you why you should love God. I would have launched into this story. 6,000 years ago, God created the heavens and the earth, and then God created humankind. And when the woman sinned against God, the man shortly followed after, and they were cast out of the Garden of Eden and damned to a life of sin. But God had a plan. He told Adam about this plan, and thousands of years later, he sent his one and only son, Jesus Christ, to die on a cross that whosoever should believe in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Jesus died in our place when we deserved the death sentence that Adam and Eve, our ancestors, put on all of humanity. But that's not the end of the story, because 3 days after Jesus was crucified on a cross, he rose from the dead, and now he's up in heaven going through the list, making his last checks in these last days to see who is righteous and wicked. When he is done going through that list, he will return and raise the righteous and the wicked, the righteous first, and then have them all stand before him in judgment. And then Jesus, at the center of the universe, will proclaim judgment on all. Now, by myself, I would be wicked, but if I believe and I love God, then Jesus can stand in my place and he is blameless. In short, if you would have asked, hey, 17-year-old Craig, why should I love God? The answer would have come back, well, so you can live forever. You don't have to die, I would say. You are worthy of death and you don't have to die. All you have to do is love God. Now, at this point, you may say to me, well, Craig, can I just say I love God? Is that enough? And Jesus will stand in my place. And I'd say, oh, no, no, no. You have to show it. And so the question might become, well, then how should I show that I love God? And I would be happy to tell you. I would say, well, you have to go to church often. You have to read the Bible. You have to pray. Don't curse. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't murder. Don't say, oh my God. Don't have sex before marriage. Don't be sacrilegious. Don't cheat. Don't listen to hip hop. Don't laugh at dirty jokes. Don't trust atheists. Don't smoke. Don't drink. Don't work on Sabbath. If you start there, I would say, you'd have a pretty good start on loving God. Now, at this point, you may say to me, you know, Craig, I've looked into it, and I'm just not going to love God because those are things I don't want to do. Some of those are fine, but I'm not into all of that. And I would have said something to you like this 17 years ago. I would have said to you, well, that's nice. Okay, well, you know, I wish you well, man, and good luck on your life. And then as you turn to leave, I would have said under my breath, sucks to be him. He has chosen to die. Because basically, there's a formula. When people say, why should I love God? In 17-year-old Craig's mind, there was a formula. You should love God, because if you do, then you will live, and if you don't, then you will die. And if this was 17-year-old Craig giving this teaching, I would have pointed at this passage and said, Jesus says the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, so that you might live. That's what he's getting at. Let's close with prayer. But if you have an engaged mind, a questioning mind, you would interrupt 17-year-old Craig and say, wait a second, why should I love God? And 17 years ago, I would have said to you, because God is love and God first loved you. And you would look at this idea that you should love God. And if you do, you'll live. And if you don't, you'll die. And you may say to yourself, that's not love. Anytime love involves force or threats or power, it's not actually love. But what it is it's the mafia. This idea that you need to love God in order to protect yourself from God is the same mentality and MO that ran the mafia in the 20th century. Basically, if you love the mafia, you'll live, and if you don't, then you'll die. In our American society, if there was a man who said, unless you pay me $10,000, I will kill you, that man would be arrested for running what we call a protection racket. A protection racket is illegal by our society's standards today. Why is it then that we believe in a God and call this God a God of love that acts in the same way? This, my brothers and my sisters, is the fallacy of Christianity. We often talk about God in a way that resembles the mafia. And if this is our testimony that you should love God because if you do, then you'll live, and if you don't, then you'll die, if that's our testimony, then we are testifying about a God who is not love. Now, at this point, I know what this sounds like. It sounds like heresy. Because so many of the people that I know have reduced the Christian message to the message of the mafia. The idea that you need to love God, otherwise God will let you die, is central to most of American Christianity. And if this is hard for you to hear, I want you to know something. I know why it's hard for you to hear. Because if I was 17 years old hearing what I'm saying right now, I would have shown up as 17-year-old Craig and said, 34-year-old Craig Hadley is a heretic. He has lost his way. He needs to study the Bible more. At the core of the message, 17-year-old Craig would say, at the core of this Christian message is a God who will save you if you love God and will kill you if you don't. That's what Christianity was to me 17 years ago. So I understand if this is hard for you to hear, and I understand if it sounds like heresy. And anytime you hear an idea that seems to threaten or undermine your understanding of what God is, it's always okay for you to ask the person saying, where did you get that idea from? So if you heard me say these things that sound like heresy, it is okay for you to ask me, Craig, where did you get that idea from? That this is the fallacy of Christianity rather than the centrality of Christianity. And I would respond to you, I got this idea from the Bible. And specifically from this story where Jesus is approached and asked what the greatest commandment is. And in order to understand what's actually going on here, you have to get at the whole context and understand that this story is just a part of a whole. We have been going through the Gospel of Matthew for the past, I think it's been 9 weeks. And the majority of Jesus' life has been spent in a place called Galilee. Now, Galilee is rural Judea. And what's different about Jesus' day than our day is that the progressive liberal ideas usually came from rural areas because the towns were often sworn to allegiance to Rome. So Jesus spends most of his time doing his ministry in the countryside, but in Matthew 21, he enters into Jerusalem, goes into the temple, clears the temple as a big statement of distrust in the religious establishment, leaves the temple, curses a fig tree, which is the symbol of the Pharisees, then returns to the temple where people begin to ask him questions. And these questions are meant to trap Jesus, but Jesus is very nimble and quick-witted and is able to answer these questions in ways that opens new realities for the people that hear them. Now, one of the questions is, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in all of the law? And that's the question we've been discussing this entire podcast. And while most Christians know Jesus' answer to that question, most Christians don't know the question that happened directly before that question. And we often digest the Bible in chunks because it's such a big book, but it's important for us to understand what comes before and after the passages we're studying in order to understand the bigger picture of what's going on. Because the question before the question that we're talking about is a question that sets the scene for Jesus's answer to the greatest commandment. So with that in mind, let's read the question before the question and Jesus's answer before the answer. I'm reading from verse 23. It says, that same day, some Sadducees came to him saying there is no resurrection. Now, it's important for us to know that the Sadducees are the ones that control the temple, and they don't believe in any resurrection. The Pharisees do, but the Sadducees don't. And the Sadducees are going to ask Jesus a question about a resurrection that they don't believe in. So they asked him a question saying, teacher, Moses said, if a man dies childless, his brother shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers among us, and the first married and died childless, leaving the widow to his brother. The second did the same, so also the third, down to the seventh. Last of all, the woman herself died. In the resurrection, then, whose wife of the seven will she be? For all of them had married her. So basically, the Sadducees come before Jesus and say, we have this custom that when a woman marries a man and the man dies without giving the woman a son, she is to remarry the brother, and the brother has a responsibility to give that woman a son. So the Sadducees come before Jesus and say, we have this tradition, and there's a situation where a man died, his wife married the brother, that man died, the wife married the next brother, that brother died, all the way down seven brothers, and then the woman died. She didn't have a child. They go before Jesus and say, in the resurrection then, whose wife will this woman be? And Jesus responds in verse 29 by saying, you are wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is God not of the dead, but of the living. And when the crowd heard this, they were astounded at his teaching. Jesus responds to a question about the resurrection by saying, God is God not of the dead, but of the living. What a strange thing to say. But given the context and the test that is before him, what Jesus is telling the Sadducees is that God is more concerned with this life than the afterlife. I will tell you that Jesus' teaching makes me uncomfortable because it sounds so non-traditional within Christianity. But the thing is, Jesus is the center of Christianity. And what he tells these religious leaders who don't believe in a resurrection is this. He said, well, God is not a God of the dead, but of the living. God is much more concerned with this life than the afterlife. And if God is more concerned with this life than the next life, then shouldn't we as human beings be more concerned with this life than the life to come? The very next question that arises in the temple is, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And the question comes back, why should I love God? And 17-year-old Craig shows up and says, so that you can live forever. To which, if a camera could cut to Jesus's face, I picture him face-palming and saying, I just got done saying God is not God of the dead, but of the living. Why are you making loving God about the afterlife or the life to come? Like, it's important for us to read this Bible in its entirety. Because we can say that loving God is all about the afterlife, but Jesus talks about loving God in a way that doesn't involve the life after this one, or the resurrection. But what Jesus does bring up is Jesus brings up a book of the Bible called Deuteronomy. Now, before we go to Deuteronomy, I want to talk about the Bible because we hear a lot of things about the Bible and it's really hard to discern which ones are helpful and which ones aren't. There are several people that think the Bible is the inerrant, perfect word of God. And there's only one way to maintain that view of the Bible, and that is simply don't read the Bible. It's really easy to believe the Bible doesn't have any contradictions if you don't read it. But if you read it, you'll realize that the Bible is filled with contradictions. And as a 17-year-old, I was terrified of those contradictions, but now I've learned to embrace those because they usually reveal a lot of fascinating things and make the text much more rich and point even more maturely toward the divine. When it comes to the Bible, it's important for us to remember that the Bible was not written by one author, but it was written by several authors over an extended period of time. And so the Bible is a collection of writings in the way that a Jewish people viewed and perceived and understood the living God playing out in their life over time. Because of this, it's important for us to know that the Bible is a story of developing human consciousness. There are these moments throughout Scripture where you can almost feel like the author is waking up to a new and better reality. One of those moments is in the Gospel of Matthew when Jesus responds, "The first and greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Now, if you know the Bible, you know that Jesus isn't coming up with this answer on his own. This is from the book of Deuteronomy, specifically chapter 6, verse 5, where Moses tells the nation of Israel that they shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. It's a word-for-word answer, with the exception of Jesus changes might to mind in order to address the Hellenistic culture that he's in. Now, because Jesus is teaching in the temple, he is teaching with the world's foremost authority on the Hebrew Scriptures in his day and age. And they would have known what else is in Deuteronomy, because if we were to approach Deuteronomy with the same question that we ask of Jesus, why should I love God? Deuteronomy 6 is happy to tell you why you should love God. In Deuteronomy 6:15, essentially the Bible tells us why the Israelites should love God. The answer is, if they don't, then the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will destroy you from the face of the earth. So when we talk about the Bible as developing human consciousness, this passage in Deuteronomy 6 is both a step forward and a step backward, much like human life. The step forward is that God invites Israel into a relationship of love. This is not a God who demands obligation or responsibility, but instead, first and foremost, invites people, specifically the people of Israel, into a relationship of love. The step backward in human consciousness from Deuteronomy 6 is that if Israel does not love God, then God will destroy them. And when you get back to that kind of theology, you realize that we're not talking about love, we're talking about the mafia, aren't we? If Israel does not love God, then God will destroy him. That is not love. And we're okay with there being a step forward and a step backward at the same time, because we recognize that the Bible is a story of developing human consciousness. Now, if you were to go forward in the Bible, you would eventually come to a part of Scripture known as the prophets. There are 17 books written by prophets, and the prophets almost all, there are a few exceptions, almost all talk about the exile that happened in 586 BCE. Now, the exile occurred in 586 BCE when the Babylonians came in and wiped out the people of Judah, dragged them across the desert back home to Babylon, and forced them to live as Babylonians. Because the nation of Judah believed in an all-powerful, all-loving God, there was an existential question that arose from Babylon. Why did this happen to us? Because after all, they believed in an all-loving, all-powerful God that would protect them. And the only answer they could come up with was, we were conquered by the Babylonians and are living in exile because God is angry with us. And it was here that a lot of fascinating writing and theology began to change for the better in exile. Because what they recognized was that they were very religious as a people, but as a nation, they had failed to take care of poor and needy people. So the step forward in consciousness for the prophets was that Israel's sin was that they loved religion more than people. And they recognized that religion and the practice of religion and religious hierarchy and religious tradition should never, ever, ever be more important than people. This is a common theme throughout the prophets. Now, at this point, some people may say, well, wasn't the prophets the one that prophesied that Jesus was coming soon? Yes, they did, but at the end of the day, it's just a small section of what they actually wrote about. They've spent much more of their time writing about social justice and Israel and Judah's failure to take care of people in need. Now, the step backward in all of this was the theology that because Israel or Judah had failed to love people more than religion, God destroyed Israel. God allowed people to die in his anger because God was upset and needed to teach Israel and Judah a lesson. This, my brothers and sisters, is not love. It's not. It's authoritarianism. It's exponential justice. It's anger, but it is not love. It's a step forward and step backwards, and it's kept within the Bible because the Bible is a story of developing human consciousness. Which brings us to the story of Jesus, sitting in the temple and being asked the question, what is it that is the greatest commandment? Jesus quotes Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, and says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And you can almost feel this pause happen as he finishes that, because you almost wait for him to say, or else God will kill you, or else God will run Israel into the ground, or else God will let the Romans win. But Jesus doesn't say, or else. Instead, Jesus gives a second commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then he says, all of the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. And so Jesus quotes Deuteronomy 6, but he leaves out the fear. Jesus quotes the prophets, but he leaves out the lesson. And the step forward in human consciousness is that Jesus points out that love motivated by fear is not love. Love motivated by fear is not love. And you may ask, well, what's the step backward here? And I would say, I haven't found one. Because the idea that love motivated by fear is not love is an actual description of what love is. It is important for us to know the entire Bible because in this move, Jesus removes the theology of you better love God or else. Because Jesus knows that love motivated by fear is not love. Which brings us back to our original questions. We asked 17-year-old Craig why it was important that we should love God. But things have changed since I was 17. And now if somebody were to ask me at the age of 34, hey, Craig, why should I love God? I would respond in a very different way. I would look at you and I would say, I think there's a better question to ask. I think there is. I think there's a better question than why should I love God? To give you an example, I'd like to talk about my wife. Now, I've been in a marriage for 7 years, and it has been a wonderful 7 years. And if you were to come to me and ask me the question, hey, Craig, why should you love Kimmy? I would respond to you by saying, I think there's a better question to ask. Because when you ask the question, why should you love Kimmy, you instantly frame the answer in a way that demands discussion of obligations and responsibilities. And so while I'd be able to give you an answer, it would be an answer that I don't think you'd find inspiring. I would tell you about how it's important for us to stay together for the betterment of our kids. I could tell you about how I made a promise in front of people and I'm trying to be a man of my word. I could tell you those things, but it wouldn't give you an answer that would really inspire you, would it? However, if you just changed one word, you would get a much better question to ask. If you were to come to me and say, hey, Craig, why do you love Kimmy? Well, I would give you an entirely different answer. Because the framing of the question has changed to one of opportunity rather than obligations and responsibilities. So if you were to say, Craig, why do you love Kimmy? I would start to tell you about her, and I would tell you stories about who she is. One story in particular is we're at the point now where we almost know each other better than we know ourselves. And a story that kind of encapsulates this encapsulates who Kimmy is as well. And it was just a few months ago, but we were at a party and somebody asked the question, what is your favorite dessert? Now, I love questions about my favorites. I don't know why. I just love to rank things. It's who I am. But as soon as the question was asked and it became apparent that everyone was going to go around the table and answer, I told the group, I said, I want Kimmy to answer before me. And then after she answers, I'm going to give you a different answer than she gave. And she'll look at me and she'll say, well, actually, that's the right answer. I'll know her answer better than she'll know it for herself. Now, my wife perked up at this challenge because she loves a challenge. And so the table came around to her, and it was her turn, and they asked her, Kimmy, what is your favorite dessert? And she responded by saying, it's cheesecake. And I looked at her, and I knew I had her, because I said, yes, Kimmy, cheesecake is probably what I guessed you would have said. However, you like something better than that. And she said, oh, Craig, tell me what I like better than that. And I said, you like it best when you have a dessert sampler plate and you get to try 6 to 8 different desserts all in one sitting. Just smaller pieces, same portion, but of different flavors. And she looked at me and she said, oh, you got me. And I tell you this story because it encapsulates who this woman is. Because my wife loves new experiences. And she loves to try new desserts. She loves to try new things. And I am so routine driven. And when you ask me, why do I love Kimmy? It's because she gets me out of my routine and gets me trying new things. And I usually love her for it. This woman has an amazing vitality for life. Another story is there's a picture that we took down in South America. And it was while we were hiking at Torres del Paine. And we were on a 5-day backpacking trip, and it's hard for me to describe this picture, but basically it's a picture where I am in a pose that is trying to make Kimmy laugh, and they took the picture right when she started laughing at me. Now, I love this picture because it's really hard to get my wife to laugh because she's kind of learned all my tricks, right? But every now and then she starts laughing, and it is the sweetest, most beautiful sound in the world. And if you watch me when I preach, and Kimmy's in the audience, and if she starts laughing, I can hear it. And it's so hard for me not to stop the sermon right there and give a fist pump because I love it. I love it when I can get this woman to laugh. Another story is we had our first kid, Maya, in December of 2013, which meant that Father's Day was 6 months later, my first Father's Day. And I came home on Father's Day. I had gone out and done a few things. And I came home and my wife had made a sign for our 6-month-old daughter to hold. And it was a big sign that it read, I heart my dad. And she, it showed how thoughtful she was. And it was just this moment where like tears started welling up in my eyes. And I loved that moment. And then lastly, we have a second kid now. My son Bodie was born in December of 2016. And the thing that's amazing about Kimmy is she makes this parenting thing, which is so difficult. She makes it look so easy. And she is a remarkable mother, and she's so prepared and loving and joyful. And my son, whenever my wife enters the room, just lights up like the best thing in the world has ever happened. This is an amazing woman, and it is a privilege and a joy to be married to her. And when you ask me the question, hey, Craig, why do you love Kimmy? I shift the conversation from obligations and responsibilities to a question where I discuss who Kimmy is, where I discuss her essence, and what makes Kimmy the woman that she is. Her essence. So if anybody were to ask me, why should you love God? I would say, I think there's a better question to ask. And if people could ask the better question, which is, hey, Craig, why do you love God? I'd respond not in a way of obligation or responsibility, but in a way of talking about God's essence and what it is that makes God actually God. So when we talk about why should I love God or how should I love God, we need to change the questions to why do you love God and how do you love God? I want you to think about those questions as you're listening to this podcast. Why do you love God? How do you love God? Because how you answer those questions matters. And I'll tell you, as a pastor, I do a lot of study in theology, a lot of study in the Bible, a lot of study in religion. And there's times that I forget to love God. I never forget to think about God, but I forget to love God. And this is the same with any marriage or any relationship of love, whether that's a sibling or a friend or a parent. There's times that we forget to love and we feel like a relationship is bogged down by obligation. And we need these moments where we cut through the superficiality of life and recenter on love and restoring that relationship to love. the same thing with God, where there's times that we can forget to remember that this bond or connection or life between us and this being that is living is a relationship of love. And so it's important for us to remember why we love God and how we love God in order to respond to this being that has given us this creation. Why do you love God? How do you love God? I'm going to answer these two questions, and these answers are not meant for you to copy them. I want to share them with you because they're my answers that I found to be the most helpful. And I think it's important that we all answer them. And I think it's important for you to ask these questions of yourself. But I want to share with you my answers to these questions because they are my story and my testimony, and I hope that you find them helpful. So if somebody were to ask me, Craig, why do you love God? I would respond by saying, I love God because the essence of this existence is good. I really believe that. It's not a perfect existence. There is pain. There is heartache. But I have found it is more good than it is bad. And I have found that it is worth fighting for the good while also fighting against the bad. It is a good thing to live on this planet, and I am grateful that God has given me the gift of this existence. I have found it beautiful to love in relationship and to give love away and to receive love. And I am thankful to my God for allowing me to live in the midst of this existence, which I have found to be good. I love God because the essence of this existence is good. And if somebody were to ask me, how do you love God? I would respond with this answer. I love God by loving all of creation as generously as God loves me. Now, this is a commitment to growth. It is a way of being in which I understand that I have more to learn about love and that God has been infinitely more generous than I could ever be. And yet at the same time, that is the goal for which I strive. Now, there are some days I do better than others. There are some days I do worse than others. But the thing that I've found that is worth living for in this life is learning how to grow in the generosity of what God has given me. And then learning how to give that generosity away. That is how I've learned to love God. And I continue to strive to grow more and more in that way. So to you, my brothers and sisters who are listening to this podcast, I have two questions that I'd love for you to think about and soon be able to answer. Why do you love God? And how do you love God? May you see and embrace this inspiration that is given in all. Amen.